Let's turn this hour to Luke chapter 6. Luke 6. We'll be looking at verses 1 through 11. As Luke takes us through the life of Jesus, we come now to a major, very significant series of events, and that is the Sabbath controversies. One of the chief areas of conflict between Jesus and the Jewish leaders was over proper observation or proper observance of the Sabbath day. And while we might say that that seems like a relatively minor issue, it was not a minor issue. It was a major area of conflict. It was an area over which the disagreement over how it should be kept was so violent that because of the way Jesus approached the Sabbath, they decided he ought to be killed. So it's not a minor thing. And while we might have differences among ourselves over things that we violently disagree, but not to the point that we want to kill one another. And while that was not Jesus' object for them, it was definitely what they intended to do with him. He so violated the Sabbath in their eyes that the only solution was to kill him. And this is a motivating force. And that, again, is a little bit hard to see because we could easily say, how could anything so minor, so relatively unimportant as the way you keep the Sabbath be an issue whereby you'd want to kill a person because you felt they so violated God's ordinance? But that's the way the Jews felt. And there we're coming, therefore, into two of the three that we have that are found here. There are three of them. The first one is in John chapter 5, 1 through 18. And in that particular section, you have Jesus performing a healing at the pool of Bethesda. And they regarded his action on that day as a total violation of everything that God commanded when he said, you shall not work on the Sabbath. And thus, at that point, they're ready to kill him. The second controversy was sort of an indirect one. We'll be looking at these two this morning. The second was over the fact that in Luke 1 through, or 6, verses 1 through 5, the disciples came through the fields and they were picking corn and rubbing it in their hands and they were eating it. The third major controversy over the Sabbath day was the one found in the following verse, Luke 6, 6 through 11. And the issue there is the healing of a man with a withered hand. And these three events in the life of Jesus are very major. They're violent. Jesus does not budge an inch on the way he believes the Sabbath should be kept. He does not back away from the fact that there was a healing at Bethesda. Picking corn was okay. Healing of a man was okay. And the reason, and we can encircle all three of these, the reason was this. They all centered on a human need. And human need was of such a nature that the ceremonial law could be set aside. And we need to use those words, the human need set aside. We will go to one, for example, where he will point out that David took bread from the Holy of Holies, which the Old Testament said for priests only, and only after 1 week. The table of showbread that was in the holy place would be loaded with six loaves, two in a row, 12 of them all total. It was there for a week. At the end of the week, the priests were to come in, remove it, put new bread in the new showbread in the cart or the table, and then the bread that remained was taken and it was to be used by the priests. And Scripture says, for priests only. David went in, or didn't go in, but David had a need, and his companions, and they were hungry. They'd gone a long time without food, and the priest goes in, takes the bread, brings it out, and gives it to them. In the strict letter of the law, violation of what the Old Testament had provided, but that was okay. And the reason it was okay, because the human need was more important than a regulation. The human need was more important than all of this. And with that, Jesus clashes, or the political or religious people clash with him over that particular thing. They did say that a human need could overcome the Sabbath day in healing if the person would have died. That's how far they went, that you can bypass the Sabbath regulation, you can take action and heal on the Sabbath day if that person would have died. Jesus said, no way. It's not true. He said, that is taken in. But any human need is bigger than the Sabbath, and furthermore, he will then come along and drop the bomb that will literally infuriate them more than anything else, and it's found in verse 5. He was saying to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. In other words, I can act and do on the Sabbath day as I please because I am its king, I am its master, I am its Lord. I gave it to you, and therefore I am sovereign over it. And over this, they literally went to pieces on this particular issue. So these are the three events that are found in the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John over the Sabbath controversy. There's some other controversies. There are things he does on the Sabbath, and there's some objections. But these three are major. They're violent. They are let's kill him issues, and therefore they are very, very big. Now, let me add at this point that whenever we come to the Gospels, events that are recorded can be in several orders, or let's put three orders. Now let me tell you why this is important. Many critics will look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, put them side by side, and find out that this event in Matthew is put after this event. But if you go over here to Luke, that same event is placed after another event. And if you go to build up the whole case to Mark, Mark puts it in a different place. In other words, we could have this kind of phenomena. We could have, let's just use the pen. This event happens at this point. And let's let this be the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Let this begin the resurrection of Christ. This is a timeline using the front of the pulpit. And this same event, one of the gospel writers will take it and he will put it back here. Another one will take it and he will put it over here. And another one will put it here. Assuming that the order of events has to be chronological, what would the critics then say? When the same event is here and it's here, somebody is wrong. Matthew is wrong in putting it over here because it didn't happen over here. Or Luke is wrong and put it over here because it didn't happen over here. It happened over here. And therefore, the critic will say the gospel accounts are not accurate. They do not see the life of Jesus the same way because of these events that seem to follow in different order. And you can see how that would be. It's part of our way of thinking. If you would talk about your teenage years, and then you would drop in an incident and find out that incident happened when you were five, you'd say, well, that's out of order. Well, here are the three orders in which not only New Testament writers, but your ancient writers think. Number one, an event can be put in chronological order, obviously. The order can be chronological order. And basically, that's the way we kind of think. That if one author writes about an event and another author writes about it, and they don't put it in the same chronological order, then one of them's got to be wrong. And that's unfortunate because that is very narrow literary thinking. There are two other ways that events can be grouped. Number one, they can be given topically. I'll give you an example of these. They can be done topically. Or three, they can be ordered logically. And not only the New Testament, but all of your ancient writers thought this way. They all said, well, now, if I want to develop a topic, then I don't have to follow chronology. All I have to do is find each event that emphasizes that topic and put it in order. So that if I want to emphasize at this point a particular topic, I may get an event from down here, another one back here, another one over here, and I will take all three and put them here. And you can see how that would be a good literary style to write topically. Logically, the author may say, well, you know, there are certain things that happen. Every time Jesus says this, the Pharisees respond this way. And therefore, there seems to be a logical sequence. Jesus does this, they do this. Jesus does this, therefore, logic, they do this. And he'll observe that. And therefore, on our timeline again, he'll take an event over here, event over here, event over here, and event over here, and put them all together because they develop a logical point. And that's a good, broad literary style that's used in many, many of your writers. Now, you always assume that they're one of these three arrangements, and it's chronological if the author uses a time word. For example, look at Matthew chapter 9. Matthew 9. And if you look at verse 18, or back before 18, you have the lesson we had last time, which talked about putting new wine in old wineskins, and about putting a patch from a new garment in an old garment, and how you don't do that. But notice verse 18, something happens. And from reading verse 18, would you say that the order is meant to be chronological, topical, or logical? Looking at verse 18, what would you say it to be? It just about has to be, doesn't it? While he was saying these things. So Matthew is careful to say, in the midst of the discussion of the Sabbath, something happened. And he does so by using time words. So for chronological order in the gospel, always look for time words. And I might put one person that loves to do that is Matthew. If we look at it from the standpoint of the Greek New Testament, the Greek language has many what they call adverbs of time. Tote. And words of that sort that are specifically intended to mark time. Something happened noon, now, at this moment. And thus you have a rich vocabulary of that type of thing. Chronological order is possible. Topical order. Let's suppose that the author, let's take John's shoes. John says, I would like to establish a topic. The topic I would like to establish and prove is that Jesus is deity. And I have, beginning with his birth, on through his resurrection, a whole bunch of facts. And I'm going to take those facts from childhood, from teenage years, from his last week on earth, from his teaching, and I'm going to pull them together under one topic. I don't care when they happened. So let's put here, the issue is not when, but what? The not when, I'm trying to break these down into simple arrangements. Topically can be simply said that the issue is not when, but what. And the what would be your topic, and it doesn't make any difference when this happens. And that's why you can go through and you'll find something in Matthew 2, and you don't find it until Luke 12. Well, they had different purposes in mind, and they were not that... Now, there could always be a mix. You could say there were two events that happened in order that proved the deity of Jesus. So under a topic, you could have topic 1, 2, 3 chronologically. That's possible too. But again, note these particular type arrangements. Logically, can be an array, and I think we've got it right here. Logically is this. Those present with Jesus should be feasting, not fasting. Those present with Jesus should be feasting, not fasting. Now let me ask you, is that logical? Does that make logical sense? Here comes Christ. He announces salvation. He announces who he is, the King of the Jews. And what does that call for? A fast or a feast? And if you come back to chapter 9, isn't that what he has said? Not chapter 9, but rather Luke 5, I believe it is. Verse 33. And they said to him, the disciples of John often fast and offer prayers. The disciples of the Pharisees also do the same thing, but yours eat and drink. And Luke says, I want to make a point that Jesus made, that it is logical that we should eat and drink. It is not logical that we would fast, and here's why. Illustration. Jesus said to them, Luke 5:34, you cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you? In other words, if you are a groomsman at a wedding, responsible as you would be for the festivities, everyone having a good time, there being an abundance of food, plenty of provisions, a good party, then how appropriate would it be for the bride's grooms to call a fast? You imagine being invited to a wedding. There will be no reception. This will be a day of fasting. You think, well, is this a funeral? Well, maybe it is. Maybe some weddings, yeah, they have been. I've seen that probably do call for fasting rather than feasting because they're tragic. But nonetheless, that's not typical. And the typical thing, there ought to be rejoicing. And that's logical. Now, does it then fit that as Jesus is talking in these words about fasting, why doesn't Luke bring in the fact that Matthew did, that this man from the synagogue comes and says, my daughter's dead, come down and raise her? Why do you think he left that out? What does it have to do with that theme? It doesn't have anything in the world to do with that theme. So what does Luke do? He leaves it out. That doesn't mean he's inaccurate. That doesn't mean he was stupid. That doesn't mean you can say, Luke, did you know that? Yeah. Luke said, yes, I know. I was there. I heard it. This man came in. But that's not the point I'm trying to make right now. I'm trying to sell you on the fact that feasting, not fasting, is the appropriate thing. So I just didn't think that event was germane. It didn't fit into the issue. And the reason these things are so important is because the critic never sees them. He always wants to create a contradiction. And it's very possible that you will have some little high school teacher or little college professor who will set up a contradiction because it's not chronological. And that is not sound. Forget the biblical part. That's not sound in a literary sense. That's not found in the classics. That's not found in your writers outside of the New Testament. That is a Hebrew style. That is a Semitic means and way of doing things. And it is perfectly logical. And it fits in not only with biblical literature, it fits in with all the literature of the time and is an important point to make. Thus, Luke leaves those things out. Now, I hope that this will give you at least enough. And one of the interesting things is when you begin to see these different arrangements, then all of a sudden you read through a passage, compare it with Mark, compare it with Matthew, and you say, isn't that neat? It didn't fit Matthew's point, so he omitted it. Now that doesn't mean the gospel writers had the right, would any writer have the right to omit facts that are germane. But the fact that he's trying to establish this point, feasting not fasting is appropriate, healing of the synagogue official's daughter is nice. It's true. It shouldn't be overlooked. It's a fact. But it doesn't suit the purpose right here. Omitting it doesn't contradict the purpose, but it, and he could have included it. He could have said at the end of this, while Jesus was teaching, this man came and so forth and so forth. It wouldn't have hurt anything, but whenever you write for efficiency, and efficiency writing means same content, less words. If you do any writing, and we just finished the outline commentary on Acts, one of the things that always happens, I go through my first draft, I send it to Jane, and it comes back severely red-penciled. And you know what the major penciling is? You use 12 words, why didn't you use 5? And you come back and you say, that's right. Little things we tend to get in speech that we carry over into our writing. Jesus observed the fact that. Can you edit that in your head? It's wordy. Why Jesus observed the fact that? Why not Jesus observed and put it in there? You've cut out words. You made it easier to read. And that is part of the skill of editing a document, cutting it down and making it less. Cutting out words, for example, that are that are not easily understood. I had a sentence here that I thought was just priceless. The Pharisees were more interested in orthopraxis than orthodoxy. And I think that's nice. Orthopraxis means doing the right thing. Orthodoxy means believing the right thing. And the comment as it came back, why not the Pharisees were more interested in doing the right thing than in believing the right thing? Well, I just thought it proved me more educated to use orthodoxy and orthopraxis. Especially since they're both compound Greek words, and why doesn't everybody love compound Greek words? But you got to remember, you're not writing for that, you're writing for a reader, and consequently economy of words. Probably the most lacking thing I see in writing, I don't know why I'm talking about this, is economy of words. And so, coming down to Luke, if he'd put in the incident about the healing of the man's daughter from, or the raising of the man's daughter from the synagogue, it would have been true, it would have been interesting, it would have been all right, but not really germane to the subject. And when you get too many things in that are not germane to the subject, what do you lose? You lose the topic you're trying to establish in the midst of all of this forest of details. So this is an important principle, and I take it right here we have in Luke a logical arrangement. So out go those two other events, and Matthew was interested in bringing them in, but not Luke was not. Okay, now, the two events, wouldn't it be logical then, if feasting and not fasting is the important point, then does it not follow that these next two events are kind of neat? They belong here, because they're illustrations of the point, and the first one is a Sabbath event focusing on the disciples. We'll just put Sabbath event, disciples. They were the focal point of this particular one, and it's 6, 1 through 5. In these two events that are coming up in Luke chapter 6, we're reminded, and Luke does not want us to forget it, he reminds us 4 times that this is a Sabbath event. For example, reading in chapter 6, verse 1, it came about that on a certain Sabbath, verse 6, it came about on another Sabbath, verse 7, the scribes and the Pharisees were watching him closely to see if he healed on the Sabbath. Verse 9, Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or destroy a life? So notice 4 times we're reminded of that fact. Notice, incidentally, coming back to verse 7. Did the Pharisees believe that Jesus really healed, or did they doubt it? Were they his friends or were they his enemies? They were his enemies, were they not? They wanted to catch him, didn't they? And yet, notice in verse 7, the scribes and Pharisees were watching him closely, to see if he healed as they knew he did, but the issue is what? Did he do it on the Sabbath? So the Pharisees would come in here, and if someone would say that miracles of Jesus did not happen, they are not real, the Pharisee would stand up and say, I hate this man. But I tell you one thing, you can't debate that he healed. I want to catch him. We want him dead. But he's not a fraud. He did do it. He did heal this man, and he did heal this man, and this man in the chapter 6 that comes out. That's right, his hand was withered, and that's right, he stretched it forth, and when he did so in obedience to Jesus, he was healed. We hate his guts, but he healed. So the testimony, you could take the testimony of the enemies of Jesus, the people that want him to dead, and you could build a real case for the reality of the miracles. Because they would come on the stand and every one of them would admit, yeah, it's true. We just got to stop him. We got to impugn the power by which he does it. We got to do something. But say that he didn't do it, no, we can't do that. We don't. That would destroy all credibility to do that. So, Sabbath event then. First, disciples accused. This is easy to divide up. Disciples accused, 6, 1 and 2. Disciples defended, 6, 3 and 4. Disciples accused, 6, 1 and 2. And notice under the accused, we have just listed 4 reminders. 6, 1, 6, 6. 7, 9. Now you can come on and let's read the incident. Verse 2. Well, reading it all, verses 1 and 2. It came about that on a certain Sabbath, he was passing through some grain fields, and his disciples were picking and eating grains, heads of grain, and rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? Now, what do you think they might be accusing him of? Forget about as much as you can. What might they be saying? Let's put it a different way. Last Thursday, I think the season's coming to an end, sort of, but let's say a month ago, one Thursday afternoon, 12 disciples came through Harold and Marie's tomato garden. And they helped themselves and went on their way. What problem do you see with that? It's simple. Taking things out of people's garden that don't belong to you is called stealing. Now, is that what they're saying here? The disciples go through, and that's what they're doing now. They go through this man's, whoever it might be, his cornfield, and he looks out from his breakfast table, and here are Jesus and the disciples. And they're standing out there pulling ears of corn off of my corn crop, and they're eating out of my garden. What would you do if someone sat down with a salt shaker and ate out of your garden? Would you say welcome? Or would you be a little bit offended because those are my tomatoes, I cultivated them, I watered them, I took care of them. I did whatever you do to tomatoes. I talked to them and prayed for them and all those things. But nonetheless, they're mine. Now, the first thing we need to set aside right here is what they were doing is they were not stealing. They were not stealing. Within our framework, we might interpret it that way. As a matter of fact, we wouldn't say we might, we would. But they were perfectly within the law. And to show that they were perfectly within the law, go to Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 25. They were not doing anything that was stealing. We need to set that completely aside. Deuteronomy 23, 25. They were acting perfectly well within the Jewish law. The corn farmer had no right to come out with his double-barrel shotgun and protect his property. He couldn't do that. They were perfectly legal, chapter 23 and verse 25. When you enter a neighbor's or your neighbor's standing grain. Now, neighbor does not mean, in the sense that we do necessarily, your next-door neighbor or close neighbor. Within the community of Israel, every other Israelite was your neighbor.
So if you come from Galilee down to the area of Judea, and you're going through a field, and it's a Jewish field owned by a Jewish man, then he's your neighbor because you're of the same fellowship of Israel or brotherhood of Israelites. Therefore, when you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads in your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. In other words, you can't harvest his crop, but if you're hungry, you can pull off ears of corn, and you can eat those ears of corn. That's perfectly legal. So in going back to Luke chapter 6 then, notice this has nothing to do with stealing. By the regulation, had they all had 12 sickles and started harvesting the man's corn crop, that'd been different. But notice what they were doing. Came about on a certain Sabbath, he was passing through some grain fields. His disciples were picking, eating heads of grain, rubbing them in their hands. So stealing is not the issue. They were legal. But some of the Pharisees said, why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? And therefore, the third point to make under this is simply this. The rabbis had a commentary on the word work. Go back, for example, to Exodus chapter 20. And I'll show you the necessity that for having a commentary. Chapter 20 and verse 8. We're in the Decalogue or the commandments. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. Problem. What is work? If, for example, we would take the overhead projector, dampen a cloth, and rub it clean, the whole roll, take 5 minutes to get the whole roll clean. Is that work? If you have a flat tire and you jack up your car, change the tires, is that work? What's work? And the legalistic mentality came along and said, we will tell you what work is. And it was absurd. It was ridiculous. I gave the illustration of changing tires. The Pharisee would say, okay, if you have to change a tire, there is a difference between whether the person who put the tire on there used a, what's that thing? Pneumatic. Air wrench, whatever you call them. And the Pharisee would look and say, you know, when they put those things on with the air wrench, they are something else to get off. However, if the person that put it on before, he probably didn't make it quite as tight as the air wrench. Now, there's the important point. You may change your tire on the Sabbath if the lug nuts were hand-tightened. If they were put on with a pneumatic thing, then you're probably going to expend a whole lot more effort. And the reason I illustrate that is one of the cars had a flat tire 2 weeks ago Saturday. I absolutely came down with all my weight. I couldn't make the things budge. Either that or some Amazon put the thing on there, but I think it's because it was put on with one of those pneumatic things. I had a flat last night. And the lug nuts were put on by me the last time I changed. And therefore, there were four of them. Usually, I figure if you got four screws and you get one in, what? Good enough. I mean, forget the rest. Maybe not on your car, but If you have four screws, do you put all four in? Do you really? But Pharisaic mentality would say, when those things are on so tight, and they would make a rule about changing your tires on your chariot. Those were put on with a pneumatic thing. Too much effort, that's work, you can't do it, you'll have to wait till the next day. And you say, well, that's ridiculous. Well, I know it was, but let me give you a little bit about the way they built this up. See the word work? Let's go down here. Here's the word work. What is work? Coming down from the word work, I don't have enough here. They had principal categories of work. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now I put 5. They didn't have 5. They had 39. And each one of these was a principal category of work. Since they were rural, one of the categories, for example, might be the whole category of what is work on the farm. So let's just arbitrarily make category number 4, farming. And here are all the things that pertain to you, if you're a farmer, that would constitute work on the Sabbath day. 39 categories of these. But that's not enough, because you come up with some things that it's too... That doesn't answer everything. Rules never answer everything. But nonetheless, under each one of these 39, then you should expand out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Because under each one of the 39, there were 6 subdivisions. And under each of those subdivisions, there were rules. The net result was this. There were literally thousands of things you couldn't do on the Sabbath day. Now, believe me, that's minor, because that's only work. There were other things. What constituted a legal fast? And you could take this noun work, and you could put all kinds of things in there. Fasting, ritual, you are to wash your hands before you eat. But wash your hands. Does that include cleaning under your fingernails? And the Pharisees and all of their egotism and legalistic mentality took that. That is important. And they would say that when you ritually wash, washing your hands is not enough. You've got some dirt under a pinky. And therefore, you must clean out underneath all of your fingernails. And but what if you're a workman and your knuckles are slightly... you got a bruise... a knuckle here that's cut. You wash your hands, clean your fingernails, but what about that cut on your index finger on the knuckle that resulted from such and such? Are you ritually clean? And the Pharisees would say, we will tell you and we will make regulations. If the cut is a quarter of an inch, you're unclean. If it's less than a quarter of an inch, you're okay, unless it's in the form of an X, and then you're not okay. Am I making it ridiculous enough? I'm trying to. Not only because it was, not only make it ridiculous, but make it impossible. Remember, Jesus made that remark to them. You put on men that kind of regulation which nobody can keep. You could not memorize without great effort all the things you couldn't do on a Sabbath. And then when you got to the end of the list, you were still shaking at the knees because you probably came up with one thing that wasn't on the list. And you don't know what to do with it. And therefore, all of this would require no judgment. It would require that you be mindless and that you give your mindlessness over to rigid obedience to rules. And that's the whole Pharisaic religion into which Jesus came to great conflict on this type thing. And Jesus has come along and he's going to say, cross it all out. The Spirit of thou shalt not work is the point. And that calls for your own thought, for your own judgment, for your direct relationship to God and His regulation, not regulating to God through a bunch of Pharisaic rules and saying, Lord, as meticulous, I kept all of them. I kept category number 4. I kept subcategory number 1 underneath number 4. And rule number 25, I kept it. Look at me. I'm good. I'm clean. I'm religious. I'm spiritual. And Jesus said, nonsense. And this is where the conflict came into the... May I ask one other thing? Do people fall in love with taboos? Do men love their taboos? You bet they do. We love our taboos, and that's one of the interesting things about the human personalities. We love them. We love them especially when we observe them and the neighbor next door doesn't. Because it gives us a means of what? Of elevating our own spiritual opinion of ourselves. He doesn't do this. I do this. I'm up here. He's down here. I feel great. I'm king of the mountain, and I kick everybody in the face that is below me, and that's how I maintain my spirituality. We don't smoke, we don't chew, we don't go with girls who do. You do. Ha ha. We're spiritual. You're sinners. Father, thank you today for your word in Christ's name.